big centers, Vancouver, Vancouver, Seattle, and all of California.
What were you doing? This end. What were you doing precisely on the Doffer line? You were on the Doffer line, weren't you?
Commanding officer, Cranberry Portage.
Cranberry Portage.
When I was transferred there after my tour at Comox.
So you're no longer an operational pilot, but you were commanding a...
No, you're in a regular sort of system here now. You have 3 years on and 3 years off, roughly.
Roughly.
I mean, you try and have 3 years on flying and then a 3 year rest tour. And the time I was in personnel branch, you had all your headquarters positions rotating every 3 years for operational people to give them a rest, you see. Mm-hmm. Well, now, after my 3 years at Comox, we just had 1 year on the Mid-Canada line and then went into headquarters to complete the ground tour, but it was all part of the ground tour.
Mm-hmm.
That was, and this is because you had to phase people through these northern stations. The Pine Tree line was half and half.
Mm-hmm.
That is half Canadian, half American.
Mm-hmm.
The Mid-Canada line was all Canadian. And the Dew line was all American, except they had a ostensibly commanding officer Canadian, they call him a commandant or something up there, military commander, I forget, anyways, but he was there strictly to sort of be the liaison between northern natives and the Americans who were running the show.
Mm-hmm.
And looking after sovereignty, make sure that they sort of abided by the treaties governing the building of the stations up there.
Mm-hmm.
But this is phasing out now as the...
Kind of obsolescence, isn't it?
Well, the threat is going down. It was all built... at a time when we had intelligence, they were going into the Bear, the big four-engine turboprop, and there's still some of them around, but they're getting pretty long in the teeth now. And
well, at that time, that was the main striking force, wasn't it?
At that time, they were the main striking force. And you had your double. You really have to sort of understand the defense setup. You see, it was at the same time as the ICBMs.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the ICBMs were inertial guidance system, and accuracy wasn't all that hot. And we were figuring in the early stages that you needed about, if you were going to go first strike strategy and you wanted to take out a Russian ICBM, you had to put seven missiles on, targeted to one of theirs, because of the inaccuracy or the center of mean error that this missile would generate through the inertial system going.
Mm-hmm.
And it meant that theirs coming this way, if they were to equal technology, would have to target seven American missiles, unless you wanted sort of mutual annihilation. It did get to that later when people went from having your missiles above ground, you started to build up together. Once you lost the 7-to-1 ratio, mm-hmm. which in the initial stages was an American advantage with their productive capacity, then you wanted to put the odds a little more in your favor, you hardened in silos. Then your ratio went up drastically, you see. Mm-hmm. Well, now, if you reach some agreement that you've got 500, I've got 500, you never get to this 7-to-1 ratio, you see.
Okay.
However, bombers were never constrained to that. They can go pinpoint accuracy as they did in World War II, so that you might have one bomber over take out one missile. This is why you built all your sort of lines and built up the interceptor squadrons. In effect, this killed the Arrow too, you see.
Mm-hmm.
I arrived in headquarters just at the end of the Arrow demise. And really, at that time, in order to adequately meet the threat and cover all avenues with arrows, we would have spent all our defense budget plus some. Mm-hmm. You wouldn't have any left for the Army, Navy, or anybody else for that matter. So this is why the Arrow went down the drain. It's, in retrospect, a shame that they wrecked the airplanes that they had, 3 or 4 at least. And it was a shame that they broke up that whole Arrow Avro team doing it. They were certainly in the forefront of technology. But this is part of the problem that you have in alliances. You see, we have first class in the forefront of technology developing this airplane. It was right at the edge of the state of the art at the time, but then Americans wouldn't buy it. They wanted to develop their own.
Mm-hmm.
And it was too expensive for us to go alone. The Brits wouldn't buy it, so it's down the tube. But you've got the same thing in NATO today, and this, in essence, this is why France has been such a an obstacle all the way along in NATO.
Mm-hmm.
Because in any sort of umbrella for NATO, you would have the Americans wanting to supply the ground radars, wanting to supply the airplanes, keep their factories going full blast, and of course this relegates all the European capacity to zilch.
Mm-hmm.
And you look at the Brits' capability over the last 20 years and you can see it in actual fact. Here they're sort of buying American Polaris's, et cetera, in order to keep technology up. But where 20 years ago, 30 years ago, they were right on the edge of technology, they no longer are,
mm-hmm.
you see. This is one of your problems.
Well, sir, I'm very near the end of my tape. And when did you retire? 1970?
79. I left the Cranberry Portage in 61,
mm-hmm.
and went into headquarters,
mm-hmm.
into operational requirements, and spent the next 9 years, 8 years, operational requirements.
And what did that mean, operational requirements?
Does well, as I mentioned, I hit there just at the demise of the Arrow,
mm-hmm.
and in looking to the 100s, we're running down, looking to sort of follow on. We, again, we're back into the sort of production side of it, we accepted 66-101 voodoos from the Americans.
Mm-hmm.
It's the Polaris story again.
Stopgap measures. Yeah.
Well, stopgap measures, but if your own aircraft industry goes down the drain, what do you do?
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the 101s were mainly peripheral to the Bomarks.
Mm-hmm.
And we put the Bomarks in to cover the major centers, that is, Lamacaze, Quebec, and north, you see, of the population centers. Well, the 101s, and then we had the 104s as the follow-up. Europe to the Sabres. Here we got into the nuclear strike role with our 104 squadrons. But here, this was partly a production decision because it was under license to Lockheed, made in Canadair,
mm-hmm.
you see.
And well, tell me, did you have anything to do with unification later on?
No.
Operational requirements? You were simply with the materiel being used by the Air Force?
Strictly airplanes. The 104s, and then we went into when McNamara enunciated the policy of rather than massive retaliation as the only alternative, go into conventional. Then we started working to give both the CF-100 conventional capability,
mm-hmm.
with rockets and bombs, and also the 104. Very uneconomic to use a strike weapon like the 104 designed to carry one little nuclear bomb to try and load on some conventionals. You see, there are two different types of airplanes. We went to the state of the art in conventionals, tail end of World War II, and what did we have? We had a great big Liberator Fortress, Halifax, one with a great big wide wing that could carry 20,000 pounders. Well, you don't do that in a 104 with a needle thin wind. You'd never get it off the runway. As it was, it took 8,000 feet to get off. But it was this type of work that I was into, and looking to sort of quick reaction forces, where we moved into a quick reaction for Norway using Transport Command, Trenton, you see, supplying everything right from here.
Mm-hmm.
The last, as we moved into the latter stages before I retired, where unification was coming in, yes, we were getting into sort of moving army companies and helicopters and this sort of thing. And we got into a fair bit of UN planning, this sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Were you happy to get out when you did?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, I think we'd served our time,
mm-hmm.
right? We were a little disappointed in the senior echelon's Air Force. They didn't seem to fight as sort of enthusiastic as the Navy did. They seemed to be more out for themselves. We had a few of the senior commanders more or less took advantage of the change,
mm-hmm.
and deserted the troops underneath them.
Any names particularly you'd like to enunciate?
Oh, no. But all that really has survived is the field echelons, the sort of NATO component and the NORAD component really survived.
Mm-hmm.
It's the green uniform effort is a whole new ball game. I don't think they were near as efficient as we were, and God help us if we start another war or get involved in another war, but...
Well, that's highly optimistic notes, sir. I'd better turn it off. I think we're at a very good, if I say. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. You're welcome. I hope